This is today's gospel reading from the New American Bible.
Matthew chapter 8, verses 1 through 4. When Jesus came down from the mountain, great crowds followed him, and then a leper approached, did him homage, and said, "Lord, if you wish, you can make me clean." He stretched out his hand, touched him, and said, "I will do it. Be made clean." His leprosy was cleansed immediately. Then Jesus said to him, "See that you tell no one, but go show yourself to the priest and offer the gift that Moses prescribed. That will be proof for them."
You can find all the daily readings at relevantradio.com/gospel or tap the prayer tab on the Relevant Radio app.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Wow, Friday is here already. I can't believe how fast this week has gone by, but here we are. Great to be with you again. Thank you for listening. The number is 888-914-9149. We have some lines open right now. People are getting into an orderly queue, so if you'd like to join them, call me, 888-914-9149. You know, I noticed especially in social media, and in particular on Twitter, I noticed a kind of spate of earthquake-related tweets and comments from some official sources. And, you know, you kind of put patterns together, and I thought to myself, I wonder if there's some reason maybe that would be driving all what seemed to me to be kind of out of the blue, a kind of flurry of earthquake-related tweets and posts on social media. Now, I don't have any inside knowledge. I don't have any reason to think that maybe scientists think that there's an imminent quake. But there have been, you know, a lot of quakes taking place around El Centro, south of the Salton Sea in Southern California. That's one example. And quite a few quakes in other parts of the country. So it seemed to me maybe this was as good a time as any to talk a little bit about earthquake safety. And I've got a little bit of information here for you on this. The first one comes from the LA Times, and it has to do with different earthquake apps that you can put on your phone. It doesn't matter where you live. You don't have to be in Southern California. But it has some earthquake app information that can give you, you know, some advanced warning perhaps so that you can know how to get secured and get your family secured. I'm thinking about living in Southern California for so many years. I was born there and grew up there and lived most of my life there. And I rode through any number of earthquakes, including some of the biggies, the Northridge quake and the Whittier Narrows quake and a few of the other ones. The first one I really took notice of was in, when was it? It seems to me it was in January of 1971. And it was a very large earthquake for me. And it happened really early in the morning, and stuff started falling off the walls. And I mean, nobody was up yet. And so we were all in bed, and I remember my bed was dancing, you know, one leg up, one leg down, the other leg up. It was the weirdest thing, and it was terrifying. And so just from experience, and all of you who have gone through an earthquake, at least something sizable enough to cause some damage, you know what I'm talking about. It's a very disconcerting feeling, to say the least. It's hard to know in the moment, what do you do? Do you stay put? Do you run out of the building? What do you do? So the LA Times has this article here, and the writer of the article, Madeline Amato, she says she tested the top 10 earthquake apps in the Apple Store. She tested them for a week, looking at their accessibility, including price, languages, user experience, accuracy. She says apps cannot predict when and where an earthquake will strike, but there is a relatively new early warning system for the U.S. West Coast. Those warnings will come through an app called MyShake. And I've downloaded this app. I've got it. I haven't had to use it. I've never gotten anything from it, but I have it. So if the big one were to hit, it might give LA a minute or two of warning, says Julian Lozos, assistant professor of geophysics at Cal State. He says this is enough time to drop, to cover, hold on to something, get underneath the table, for example. And Madeline Amato, the writer of this article, she gives a few other examples of the apps. She says, at first glance, the apps are fairly similar. They provide the date, time, location, magnitude, and more on most recent earthquakes around the globe. Most are data aggregators pulling information from the U.S. Geological Survey or its European counterpart, the European Mediterranean Seismological Center. All are free. Some have paid upgrades, anywhere from $0.99 to $6.99, and that will remove ads and give you more specific filters as you wish. Earthquakes are a fact of life in Southern California. So here are some things that you need to know. First is, ask yourself, how ready are you? How much water do you have on hand? Most recommendations are to have 1 gallon per person and pet for 3 days. In a warm climate like Southern California, you probably will want more than that. If you smell gas after an earthquake, do you know how to shut off your gas meter? Do you have an early warning app on your phone? What would a seismologist do? You want to learn more? So that's where these apps can come in very handy. Should you download the Red Cross apps? Another question. This app, she says, never sent me any alerts and it doesn't act as an earthquake tracker or early warning system. However, it is a valuable resource for Southern Californians as it has supplemental information on what to do before, during, and after an earthquake. It's also free as well. Should you download the Last Quake app? This is the official app of the EMSC. That's the European version. It has visual resources. She says they're like IKEA instructions. And it gives you tips on earthquake preparedness and response. It's available only in English, but the images allow the app to be easily navigable. And she says an app that you really should look into is MyShake. And as I say, that's the one that I downloaded about a year ago or so when I first became aware of it. Now, Cyrus, if I'm not mistaken, don't we have a little bit of audio that talks about this topic?
Yeah, we do. So this is some scientists saying, you know, this is how to survive an earthquake. This is how to put yourself in the best chance for survival.
Okay, good. Let's listen.
Suddenly, a loud crash. A dish falls on the floor in your kitchen. Your dog barks and more things fall and smash. Your feet feel unsteady on the ground. What's happening? It's an earthquake, and you need to act fast. If you don't, you could get injured, trapped, or worse. So, how do you survive an earthquake? Well, here's how to do it, according to science. Earthquakes can happen anywhere, at any time. The Earth's outer crust is made of tectonic plates floating on the planet's upper mantle. The edges of these plates, called fault lines, are where most earthquakes occur. When the plates butt up against each other and get stuck, that causes pressure to build up. Once the plates move again, that's when an earthquake happens. During an earthquake, drop, cover, and hold on. If you're in a car, pull over. If you're indoors, do not stand in a doorway. Once thought to be the safest place in an earthquake, a doorway is no stronger than any other part of a building. After an earthquake, stay alert. There will be aftershocks, which are much smaller tremors. If you're in a damaged building, get outside and move away from it. If you've been trapped in a falling building, try to stay calm. Cover your mouth to keep debris from getting into your airway. Send a text if you can. Bang on a pipe or use a whistle to get a rescuer's attention. If you're near a large body of water, go inland and up to higher ground right after the major shaking has ceased. After an earthquake is when the tsunamis happen. Do not enter damaged buildings. If your radio, TV, or smartphone are still working, check for emergency information and instructions. If you want to help, then keep yourself safe while doing so. Do not try to lift heavy debris by yourself, and wear protective clothing when volunteering in a rescue or cleanup. Earthquakes are dangerous, but if you follow this advice, you have an excellent chance of walking away unscathed, according to science.
According to science. They have to hire guys that have that crackly voice, the guy who does the movie thing.
Serious. That could be a scientist, you don't know.
According to science.
Yeah, we all know it's not.
He got hired for his voice. He's got a good voice. But, you know, it's always that same, you got today or this year's best movie, whatever it is.
Coming this summer.
That's the guy. I don't know if it's the same guy, but it's that voice. Well, there it is. So I just, there's nothing more to tell you about that. Obviously, earthquakes come suddenly and without warning. But if you have at least some preparation, it's better than nothing, right? So be prepared. As the Boy Scouts say, be prepared. Also, I don't know how they possibly could have prepared for this one, but the Hubble telescope computer, the onboard computer that processes the images that it takes, it has stopped working. Now, this is after 30 years of constant use. This is according to CNN. After a June 13th malfunction, Hubble's payload computer stopped receiving the keep alive signal. That's a standard handshake between the payload and main spacecraft computers to indicate that all is well. I wonder if on board the Hubble it plays Staying Alive by the Bee Gees. That would be interesting if every time they did the keep alive signal. Of course, there's no one there to hear it. But I think it would be funny, wouldn't it? If they had installed a little micro speaker and the Bee Gees singing Staying Alive. I could see it. Now, see, that's the way I would build a Hubble telescope. To introduce a little bit of humor to the whole thing. All right. Settle down. Following the main computer's automatic shift of all science instruments to safe mode, control center personnel at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, easy for me to say, restarted the payload computer, but it soon halted once again on June 14th. The telescope and the other instruments remain in good health, but the computer can't process it. It's a NASA Standard Spacecraft Computer, or NSSC-1, if you want the specifics, built in the 1980s. It's part of the Science Instrument Command and Data Handling Unit, a module on the Hubble Space Telescope that communicates commands to Hubble science instruments and formats data for transmission to the ground. The current unit is a replacement that was installed by astronauts on the shuttle mission back in 2009, and that was after the original unit failed in 2008. I wonder if they said, dude, you're getting Adele this time. I'm doing this for your sake, Cyrus. I'm trying to...
Just think of nothing lasts for 30 years anymore. And this is a quality product. Refrigerators don't last that long.
No, they don't.
Nothing. No. Nothing lasts that long. Think of what a microwave... Were there microwaves 30 years ago? I don't even know if there were.
We got, Nancy and I... By the way, there are things that last for 30 years. My marriage... We're 40 plus years
yeah,
now.
Yeah, congratulations on that.
Yeah, thank you. But that was back on February the 7th. But no, I know what you're saying. Planned obsolescence, I think, is the term for it, where the manufacturers, they could, I suppose, make things to be much more durable, but they know that if they give it a certain lifespan and things start to break down, they can sell another product. So from that standpoint, I could see why they do it. I don't like having to buy a new product every X number of years. But I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, the companies so the like it.
But so in other words, I think in this case, because there's no consumer who's going to get stuck having to buy a new one, mm-hmm. other than maybe the American taxpayers, they did build it for a long term.
So is the hub, can it, how do you fix it? I mean, is it dead in space? Is it just floating debris now?
No, I don't. I mean, obviously, it's far too valuable to just abandon it. My assumption is that they'll send another space crew up there, or they'll move the International Space Station close to it. And who knows? Maybe Jeff Bezos will hop out with his soldering iron. Or Richard Branson. Yeah. You know, one of those guys might go up there and fix it.
Yeah. I just think of some of those epic photographs that we've had because of the Hubble. And
It's unbelievable, it really is. It's the stuff that it can see, stuff that's billions of light years away. In fact, for what it's worth, Cyrus, I posted a couple of images on my Twitter feed. Let me pull the one up here. It almost looks like you're looking at, like, not carpet, but it almost looks like you're looking at some kind of composite pavement, because it is a picture. It looks like pavement. If you go to my Twitter feed and scroll down, it says, this is from physicsastronomy.org. 500 million stars in the Andromeda Galaxy as seen by the Hubble Space Telescope. And if you didn't know, you'd think that you were looking down at some kind of pavement. But it's millions of stars in just a very small area. And this is a picture taken by the Hubble. You really should see it. It's quite astonishing.
I love
and then there's
kind
another one. Where's that other one? I have another one. Oh, yeah, the other one. It's a little further down. It's a black hole. It's the NGC 6302 nebula, as estimated surface temperature of about 250,000 degrees Celsius. its wingspan. This is a truly beautiful, remarkable image taken by the Hubble. And the wingspan on this, it kind of looks like a psychedelic butterfly, but better. It says that the wingspan, it covers 3 light years. The distance light travels in a year times 3. And this is just one nebula. I'm going to retweet that because I want everyone to see that. It's just very striking. Anyway, so that's the kind of stuff that we're learning and seeing from the Hubble telescope. Thank God for that. I can't imagine, Cyrus, what the next generation of the Hubble telescope is going to be.
I can't imagine it either.
How are you doing on science jokes?
I'm okay with science jokes. Got any?
You're all stocked up?
Do you have some?
I do, as a matter of fact. And we're going to get to some phone calls here as well. I mean, they really are terrible, but the kids love them. So this is for the benefit of the kiddos out there. Want to hear a joke about potassium? The answer is K, just the letter K.
K. Oh, I get it.
Remember chemistry? Potassium, that's the K. Symbol for...
Okay, oh, boy. K.
Why can't you trust atoms?
Why?
They make up everything. I
hope
your kids
are
listening.
Like scientist dad jokes.
They're really bad. I was reading a book on helium. I couldn't put it down.
Oh, man.
it goes downhill from there. It's already pretty far downhill. So we won't inflict any more trauma on anyone. But those jokes are there if you want to.
All right, one more. How about give me the best one.
It was already on the ground. Let me find it.
I
had to bend down
that.
And pick it up.
It's like the old David Letterman when he'd throw the paper behind him and crashes through the window.
Okay, so did I do the one about why you can't trust atoms?
Yes.
Because they make up everything? Yep. Did I do the one about I was reading a book on helium, I couldn't put it down?
You did that one, yeah.
Okay. How much room do fungi need to grow?
I don't know.
As mushroom as possible. All right. Can I please be done with this?
Please. Everyone is asking
you.
Please.
Everyone's begging. Please. All right. To the phones. Let us go to Tom in Monterey, California. Hi, Tom.
Stay in the lab.
Love your show. Love your show.
Right on, Tom. You got us off to a good start.
Isn't that the truth? And Catholics can be happy, and I just hate it when I go to a mass and they get these grumpy people, and it's like, you should be the happiest people on earth. But anyway.
I have a question for you,
point.
Tom. Before you get rolling, I have a question for you. First of all, do you like Relevant Radio?
I love Relevant Radio.
You love Relevant Radio?
Tom,
here's my question. How deep is your love for Relevant Radio?
Oh, no. Oh, you
couldn't see that coming?
You
Come
walked
on.
Into that one, Tom.
I did walk into that one. Oh,
it's a tragedy. Come on, guys. You know, we got to... Okay.
Oh, boy. Now half the audience just hung up. So, I tell you. So here's my thing. And yesterday, it's one of those little things that hopefully it's the Holy Spirit speaking to me. So the USCCB is meeting to talk about how they give the Eucharist to, communion to people who are adamantly opposed to what the Catholic teaches, right? The Catholic Church teaches. So my idea was go ahead and present this to, and for, I'll just pick a person, right? Or this guy, Tom, who is totally opposes to what the Catholic teaches, but he's adamant about, I am going to get the Eucharist. Mm-hmm. So the procession comes down to get the Eucharist. The priest stops the procession, goes up, not to the altar, to the table, picks up an unconsecrated host, and gives it to Tom. You fulfilled it. Hey, there's your communion. If you want
to, I get
play
what
games,
you're saying. No, I do get what you're saying. I do. Now, obviously, the reason we couldn't do that is because that would trivialize what's happening at the Mass, and neither of us would want that. I'm sure what you're saying is tongue-in-cheek, but I do get the point you're making. Did you see, what was it, Ted Lieu? He was a presidential candidate in the last...
I heard that yesterday. Wow.
He basically said, and I mean, he did say the words, I dare you to defy me from receiving the Eucharist. He listed, I support several things that the church is opposed to, including abortion. And he says, and I'm a Catholic and I support these things, and I dare you to refuse to give me communion. Not a very Catholic attitude.
Pride.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Well, Tom, thank you.
All right, Patrick. Love your show.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And no, Cyrus, no more jive talking, okay? We've got to get back to business, back to work. I'm surprised you haven't jumped in. Whatever. I'm waiting. I'm waiting for you. You have nothing.
I wasn't a part of this.
You got nothing. Okay. All right. Let's go out on a high note. We'll take a break and we'll come back with more of your phone calls. The number is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Be right back.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, Cyrus, same era, different band, of course, and slightly different genre, but I like it. I remember this song.
You call this a different genre?
Well, I mean, it's disco. It's true.
But well, as long as you're having the time of your life.
Yeah, Mamma Mia, let's get going with the show. Come on. Are they going to be sending an SOS if we don't get going
okay,
soon?
Okay, please stop.
I will punish you relentlessly with song titles.
I am being punished.
Okay. Let's go to Mike in South Jersey. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Patrick and Cyrus. Yeah, you know, I just wanted to ask you a question. I wanted to make very clear. I don't subscribe to this view, but I've heard it articulated, and I'd like to hear your response so I'm more prepared the next time it's brought up to me. So, and I know children are listening, so I'm going to use somewhat cryptic language. Okay. So, like the church teaches, we believe in traditional marriage, and I've heard it said by people I'm associated with that the scriptural warnings against, let's say, non-traditional marriage, which are prevalent, and I'm well aware of them.
The alternative to one man, one woman, or some form thereof, right? Okay.
Yeah, the warnings against that, which are prevalent, people have said to me that they are somewhat obsolete and outdated, and to defend that position, which again I do not subscribe to, but to defend that position, they mentioned that I believe it may be in Deuteronomy, one of the older the beginning of the Old Testament.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the passages, so just give me a kind of wrap it into
it. There's verses that talk about like menstruating women not being able to enter the assembly or something to that effect. And naturally we don't follow that anymore. So they were suggesting that likewise we shouldn't follow the warnings against non-traditional marriage. My response has always been that, well, look, we have the Pope and the teachings of the church and the magisterium that help us interpret the scriptures. And that's where we put our faith in, because Christ instituted the church through St. Peter, which I think is a pretty good answer. But I wondered if you had a better answer, or if there's something that I'm missing that would
help me
even
defend it
stronger.
I have a somewhat different answer. Yeah, I would answer the question somewhat differently, but try it on for size. I would say that this is one of the difficulties with those passages where you've got a variety of things that are lumped together in the same passage that don't have the same weight, nor are they necessarily moral issues. For example, the second issue that you just mentioned about the woman on her monthly cycle, that was part of the ceremonial law's prescription against ritual uncleanliness. So whereas in the case of sodomy, that's a grossly immoral act in itself. It's intrinsically evil in itself. And the natural cycle that a woman has obviously is not. So there would be an example of where, wouldn't it be nice if there were a strict sort of delineation where Moses said, these things are ceremonial in nature, symbolic in nature. These things are moral or immoral in themselves, and they're in a different category, but it doesn't say that. So there's this mix of both kinds that you find in the whole chapters or in whole chapters, and that's how I would respond to it. So I would say in the case of the woman, that's just simply, that was it was a ceremonial ritual impurity or ritual uncleanliness. The same thing would apply if you entered into the precincts where pagans lived, or if you touched a dead body, or after childbirth, for example. There were other ways in which you could be ritually unclean, but it had nothing to do with your actual status before God. Now, to help you a little bit further, and I hope that answer helps a little bit, but to help you further, I did a mock debate 3 or 4 years ago with Father Mike Schmitz on the topic of same-sex marriage. And I took, because that was the role assigned to me, I took the position of defending it, and I used many of these same arguments. I don't remember now if I used that particular argument, but I did bring up, as I recall, you know, why is it that you insist that this is wrong when there are other things in the same passages of Scripture that are also said to be wrong, but you accept those now? If you can accept those things, why don't you accept this thing? I do believe that was one of the arguments that I used in this mock debate, and that's available on YouTube. So if you go there and just type in Patrick Madrid, Father Mike Schmitz, same-sex marriage debate, you'll find it. It's been viewed, I don't know, 250,000 times or something like that. And that covers the span of 2 hours. So you'll get quite a bit more information. And I should say also that Father Mike Schmitz, he did a very, very good job of defending and explaining the traditional marriage position. And I did as well of a job as I possibly could. I wanted to make a really honest effort to not sandbag, but to really give the best arguments that I could find in favor of same-sex marriage. Even though I don't believe in those arguments, I wanted to present them fairly. So I think you'll get some really good information on that score. I hope that's helpful, Mike, and I appreciate your phone call. Thank you. Let's go to Matt now in Chicago. Hi, Matt. Welcome.
Hi, Patrick. First-time caller, long-time listener. You have been an influence in my life. I love your show. I love you.
Thank you.
I pray for you. Not every day because I'm bad, but most days. So thank
whatever you,
you
can spare, I sure appreciate it, Matt. I'm grateful.
So I had a handful of questions regarding the moral culpability and legality of using fetal cells and in particular with the coronavirus. So should I dive right in, or do you want me to give a setup, or what would you like me to do?
Well, maybe just perhaps we could start with whatever your the first question is, or the main question.
Sure. Well, it's three questions. Is it currently legal to take aborted fetuses and use them for science, so scientific research or whatever?
Is it currently legal? Well, sure. As far as the American laws are concerned, it is, yeah, unfortunately.
Uh-huh. Okay. Two, given that there are cell lines, aborted fetal cell lines in existence already, that's where you take an aborted fetus, you take some cells, and then you replicate them using scientific processes.
Mm-hmm.
Given that they already exist already, and some of them have been used for COVID vaccines in various shapes and forms, doesn't it make sense to use them for some good because it's already been done?
Well, the moral theologians on that point, Matt, would say in response, well, we can draw a parallel here with stolen money. So those cells were, in essence, stolen from the little child who died as a result of the abortion to harvest those cells. So if you said, well, look, here, there's, you know, $1 million in stolen money, and here it is. I mean, it's already been stolen, and it's already sitting here on the table. Shouldn't we put it to some good use? Well, Catholic moral principles would say, no, the appropriate thing to do, the just thing to do, would be to restore it to the person who lost it, or the person from whom it was stolen. Now, in this case, you can't do that because the child is dead. So it becomes a question of what do you do with ill-gotten goods? And that's the problem, if you ask me, and that is that here you're right, we have this genetic material, but they're ill-gotten goods, so to speak. So is it really moral to say, well, you know, they're already dead, might as well make use of it? That seems to be the crux of that debate on whether or not it would be licit and moral to make use of something that was in essence stolen from somebody else. So I factor that into your question as part of my answer. Mm-hmm. And what was the third question, Matt?
So just to follow up, this is sort of like part two, since due to your answer. Does it then make it not licit and moral to use these things that cannot be restored?
I think a strong argument can be made to say, yes, it is immoral to do that. I don't claim to have the last word on the topic, but I find myself persuaded in the direction that unless there's some unbelievably compelling reason to do so, that it would be better not to do so.
And could you provide a reference for that so I can go on? I'm sure it's a longer argument than just a quick phone call.
Yeah, sure. It would be much more expansive in the National Catholic Bioethics Center Quarterly Journal, which I've subscribed to for many years, and I've seen articles and read articles on this very topic. So if you wanted to contact them, their website is ncbcenter.org. They're headquartered just outside of Philadelphia. And okay. I'm sure if you were willing to pay a couple of bucks or whatever they would charge, they could send you either that volume or they could send you a PDF of articles that deal with that question.
Okay. Perfect.
So if you want to follow up.
So the third question then, I think I already know the answer to it based on, you know, just thinking about it a few more minutes. Given the fact that it isn't licit or moral to, for whatever reason, someone decides that they don't want to get the COVID vaccine. You could potentially get it. And then you are a vector then for transmission of the virus. And you might not know that you have it because, you know, some people are asymptomatic, right? So you could potentially be killing people by, you know, transferring the virus that you have to someone else. What is the moral culpability for then transferring this virus, which is then going to be killing people? I'm guessing that you don't have moral culpability because you wouldn't know that you would be sick. And if you were symptomatic and you still went out, then maybe you would have more culpability. But if you were asymptomatic, you clearly wouldn't. But what happens if you did have some symptoms?
Okay, as best I understand it. So in that scenario, there would be a sort of an a priori moral, not culpability, but let's just say you would have a role, or there would be some moral dimension a priori in so far as if you know that you could be carrying a disease, let's say this disease, which, by the way, is, you know, 98.9% or whatever the very high number is, of people are not going to catch it and die from it. They recover more or less easily, as we've seen over the past year and a half. But nonetheless, let's use your scenario. I think that a priori, there is a moral responsibility if you know that you could be asymptomatic and still carry this virus that could kill some tiny small percentage of the community if they were to contract it from you. There is a moral responsibility there. And here, too, there has been a debate, even among bishops, as to whether or not there is a strict moral imperative to get vaccinated. And that's not, as far as I can tell anyway, that has not been definitively stated one way or the other. I think many people have the strong feeling that you do have a moral imperative to get vaccinated, not only for your own safety, but for that of others. But the question remains, if I can expand your scenario, Matt, the question remains, what about all those, at least in this country anyway, probably well over 100 million people who have gotten COVID-19 and recovered from it easily, and they now have natural antibodies? I've been trying to keep up with the medical literature, and some of the things that I've read recently suggest that a vaccine for those people is superfluous right now because they already have maybe even a more robust form of immunity from the disease than one could acquire by receiving the vaccine. So these are a lot of interesting questions that are still unanswered, at least not in any definitive sense. But I guess my response to that third point would be, if you're aware that you could be carrying this disease and it could, in theory, even though the probabilities are very low, but let's just say you could pass it on to somebody else who could die from it, then yes, there is a kind of moral responsibility that I think militates in the direction of either getting that vaccine or not putting yourself in a situation where you're going to be coming into contact with those people. How one would do that, I don't know. But that would be my response to your question.
Thanks so very much, Patrick. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Matt. Thank you. And thank you for those occasional prayers. I really do appreciate those. Speaking of occasional, we have occasional breaks we have to take, and we're at the point where we're going to take one now, but we'll come back to the phones. Here's the number to dial if you want to be on the program. Maybe you've got a question. Maybe you need a second opinion. Maybe you heard something that doesn't sound quite right. Maybe you disagree with me. Whatever it is, I'd love to hear from you. Everyone's welcome. 888-914-9149. I'll be right back. The programming you hear throughout the day on the Relevant Radio Network is sponsored in part by Christendom College. More info at getprinciples.com. We thank them for supporting Relevant Radio.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
Hey, all right, we are back, and I've been wanting to give you an update on that terrible situation in Florida with the collapse of the building. Many people are still missing. They've already found some dead bodies, and I asked our own Glenn Leverance to join us. He's our news guy, our ace news guy, and Glenn has agreed to spend a little time with us updating us on this terrible story in Miami Beach. Glenn.
Well, Patrick, much rather weigh in on ABBA song titles and the like for you, but we do have that serious news as just north of Miami, the night before last, a 12-story condo tower collapsed and the rescue efforts continue. Got some audio from the mayor in that area as well as fire officials. The number of people unaccounted for in that collapse is much higher this morning.
Unfortunately, this has been a tragic night. We do have 120 people now accounted for, which is very, very good news. But our unaccounted for number has gone up to 159.
That's Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava. This morning she said again, 159 people unaccounted for. That number had been at 99. The locations in Surfside, Florida, just north of Miami Beach. The mayor again said no one, though, is giving up.
We will continue search and rescue because we still have hope that we will find people alive. That is exactly why we're continuing. And that is why we're using our dogs and our sonar and our cameras, everything possible.
And the Assistant Fire Chief of Operations of Miami-Dade, Rady Jadala, said rescue crews continue to hear sound from beneath the rubble.
We have hope. And every time that we hear sound, we concentrate in that area. So we send additional teams utilizing the devices, utilizing canine, utilizing personnel. So as we continue to hear those sounds, we concentrate in those areas.
Once again, the mayor said 120 people accounted for. The death toll officially has risen to 4, but again, well over 100 still unaccounted for. So we expect that death toll, sadly, to go higher as that rescue and recovery effort continues, Patrick.
Yeah, thank you very much for that, Glenn. It's a terrible story. And I had an opportunity to see the collapse of the building. There was, it looked like maybe a security or ring doorbell or something that took the video of this collapsing. Have you had a chance to see that yet?
Yeah, from kind of across maybe a block away or something,
yeah.
It looked like. But it looked like it pancaked down. Some likened it to the way some buildings collapsed during 9/11, but just kind of that pancake on top of one another, or the way a demolition, if done properly, kind of comes down like that. But, man, middle of the night, people had no notice.
They were sleeping. And, you know, what really struck me about this is that from that vantage point across the street or whatever it was, it looked as though there were three distinct sections of this building, almost like two towers on either side, and then the center part is what collapsed from what I could see. And it just, in a matter of 2-3 seconds, it just disappeared. What was it, 12 stories, something like that? just completely collapsed. And oh my gosh, I can't imagine the anguish that the people who live there with their loved ones and such who are missing are experiencing right now. But we bring people up to date on this story because, first of all, it's a breaking story, but also because it's a good opportunity to pray for all those who have died, but also for the people who are suffering right now, who are trapped, and for those who are suffering not knowing what has happened to their loved ones. So I appreciate you bringing us up to date on that. Thank you, Glenn.
Sure thing. More at the top of the hour. Yep.
Sounds good. Thank you. Glenn Leverance, everybody. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. We have plenty to get to. A few other quick things I wanted to mention. If you've spent any time in parts of Los Angeles, I got to tell you, the homeless problem is out of control. It is not even, it's light years beyond anything I've seen, with homeless encampments all over the place, taking over city streets. Go to Venice Beach, for example. It's out of control. And people now are not even safe to walk the streets because of mental health issues and drug issues and people attacking them. And I won't even get into some of the more grim aspects of this, which you'll find on the sidewalk, for example. But it's interesting to me that Los Angeles County Sheriff Alex Villanueva, he publicly criticized his political rivals. This is from the Daily Wire. He gave a press conference the other day, and he urged elected officials to declare the homeless crisis in the region a state of emergency. He defended a plan that he's proposing to clear encampments lining the famous Venice Beach boardwalk by July the 4th, and he described the situation there as a microcosm of what's going on throughout the entire county of Los Angeles. Now, as you might imagine, several activist groups and progressive politicians, the far-left people, they have condemned his strategy, which Villanueva says is based on the concept of regulating public space. The sheriff said local politicians have handcuffed the Los Angeles Police Department from enforcing the law, adding that their lax policies are luring more homeless people from out of state, making LA the recipient of a national problem. Villanueva staged a multimedia presentation that included images of homeless encampments, news clips of fires and violent confrontations in the Venice neighborhood, and various graphs that says he says prove the failed formula applied year after year is not working. He identified L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti, the L.A. City Council, and the powerful L.A. County Board of Supervisors as, in his words, the architects of failure. I think that is a perfect way to describe this nonsense. The architects of failure, claiming that they don't want law enforcement involved with solving homeless issues. Villanueva said that their inaction and refusal to adjust their policies as the homeless count increases over the years has forced him as the sheriff to step in. And people's lives are at stake, not least of whom are the people who are on the streets themselves. And if you've driven through parts of LA, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Now let's go to the other side of the country, to the great state of New York, where Governor Andrew Cuomo just signed a law yesterday, in fact, that allows New Yorkers to change their sex on official documents like birth certificates. And in this new law that was signed in the middle of Pride Month, I wonder if there was any symbolism intended there. It simplifies the process for transgender and LGBTQ people, which is redundant, by the way, because that's what the T in LGBTQ stands for. But anyway, it will allow them to change their names and their sex on their birth certificates. New Yorkers who wanted to change their names previously had to publish their old and new name, address, and date of birth in a newspaper, according to a press release from the governor's press office. The Gender Recognition Act eliminates that practice, according to the press release, and, quote, creates a process to petition a court to change an individual's sex designation or recognize their gender identity. And that can be sealed to protect against fear of reprisal or retaliation. It's also a good way to hide. If you've done some crime and you want to blend in and get away from people who might be trying to track you down, if you do this, that's one very good way to do it. Trans and gender nonconforming New Yorkers deserve ID reflecting who they are, Governor Cuomo tweeted on Thursday. Every New Yorker, he said, deserves to be free from discrimination and have state-issued identification and processes that respect them for who they are, recognize their gender identity, and protect their safety, the governor said in a statement. He said, New York continues to lead the way in ensuring LGBTQ people are treated equally in every part of the law and society, and this bill is another landmark that ensures New Yorkers can express ourselves for who we are. Well, I have a question, Governor, Your Honor. you say that this is to treat everybody equally. I'm all in favor of that. I really am. I'm completely supportive of any legitimate measure to ensure that everybody is treated equally in every part of the law and society. So here's my question. You're saying that LGBTQ people are able to modify their birth certificates and change their sex, change their name, etc. Is that true for everybody else? Is that true for the inmates on Rikers Island? Is it true for them? Can they just like change their birth certificates just because they want to? I mean, they're not transgender. I mean, can just some guy just say, you know, I want a fresh start. I want to change my name and I want to change my sex and I just want to change things. Is this open to everyone else indiscriminately so that anybody for any reason whatsoever can change his birth certificate or other legal documents, because this extends to more than just birth certificates? I'd like an answer to that question. Now, I'm not a New Yorker, but I'll consider myself, I'm going to identify as a New Yorker here for just a moment. So I'm identifying as a New Yorker. So you must respect me. And I would really like to know, I'm assuming that Governor Cuomo listens to the program for 3 hours a day. Why wouldn't he? But I'd like to know. So please have your office call me, 888-914-9149. Have your office call me and let me know the answer to that question, please. I just want to make sure that you really mean what you're saying, that everybody must be treated equally in every part of the law and society. I want to know if this new measure, this new law, if it extends to everybody who's not LGBTQ++, to be able to make these modifications on their documents for whatever reason they think that they should do it. And I'll report back to you, everybody, what I find out from Governor Cuomo when he calls me. I have another question and then we'll move on. What about race? Now, you know the answer to this question, but what about race? If scientifically, anatomically, physiologically, chromosomally, all the other ways in which science can measure somebody's sex, their gender. And I know they argue that gender and sex are different. I don't agree with that. But regardless, if you can decide that you want to change to something else, even though the science says that you are male or female, and don't start up with me about hermaphrodites and the situations where it's ambiguous. I understand all that, and we take all that into account. But those are very infrequent. And in terms of the percentages of people who are walking the streets, the number of people who have that actual physical problem are very few. So in any case, what about race? If you're free to change your sex, why shouldn't you be free to change your race? Let's say that you would prefer to be Mexicano. Or you would prefer to be white, or you'd prefer to be black. Take your choice, whatever. I mean, isn't that the logical next step? If you can redefine who you are in terms of your sex, why can't you redefine who you are in terms of your ethnicity? Because it's all science-based anyway. It's the same set of markers that would tell you what your ethnicity is, that can tell you what your sex is. And I'd love to hear an answer to that question. I've never heard one, actually. And all I know is that if you dare to maybe take a taco recipe that you learned when you were spending some time down in Mexico and you come up to the U.S. and if you happen to be white and you open a taco joint and you advertise the fact that this is an authentic recipe that I got when I was down in Mexico, they will sue you out of existence for cultural appropriation. And that's just tacos. That's just a recipe. But what if you were to say, I want to identify and I want you to accept me as Mexican, or black, or Chinese, or what have you? That's cultural appropriation. That is wrong in people's eyes. I just want to know, why is it wrong? If that's wrong, then why isn't changing your sex wrong? And if it really just amounts to what people think about themselves, and this is how I identify, then what's stopping you from identifying in any other way possible, including your race? Maybe Governor Cuomo can let me know about that too. Governor Cuomo, when you have a moment, please call me. My number is 888-914-9149. Cyrus, you had a story you wanted to share on that score.
Oh, you mentioned a couple of things came to mind. There was the woman, I don't know, a year or two back, the white woman, I think she was teaching black studies and she identified as black and she changed her name. And then it came out that she was white and she lost everything, from what I understand.
I think that was Rachel Dolezal, if I'm not mistaken. That's right. She was actually working for the NAACP.
Yeah, and I'm reminded of another story of in Portland, Oregon. There were a couple of white women that created a taco shop, and they got closed down because of cultural appropriation.
Because they learned the recipe, I think it was for tortillas, handmade tortillas. They had spent some time down, I think it was Mexico, because we covered this story on the show.
Right.
Back when Kaylin was here. And they proudly announced, you know, in their advertisement that this was authentic Mexican, I believe it was Mexican, food that they had learned.
The people
came unglued. They were furious with these two white women because they did that. Cultural appropriation.
But a male athlete can take the gold from female athletes.
Right. Yeah, that's the world we live in now. We live in clown world that is run by children. That's where we are. That's why we need relevant radio, if you ask me, to push back against this insanity. When, oh Lord, when? Well, we'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show and your phone calls right after this. La, 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 la.